Accession number 9955, reel number 16.
Mr. Calvert, reel 15. Are you telling me about a typical attack?
Well, we reorganised following the affair of Lost Patrol, and we had the 62nd Division on our right. Now, this attack, we were waiting, we were constantly fired on by machine guns.
Were you in trenches or just ditches, or it was open warfare, was it?
Was more or less trenches. I suppose there'd been trenches which were probably used for training purposes. Because I think this was at St. Ledger. And the 62nd Division, it was Yorkshire Division, was on the right of us. Now, we were helped by field guns which had come up to help us in this attack.
In this one you had some field
guns? We had some field guns, but the Germans also had numerous machine guns. And we set off, it was daylight. You can tell how far away from the German line at that time because we went in single file for probably half a mile. Before we then were given the orders to open out in line to go forward to the attack. And I was with this fella called Bumpin, who carried the Lewis gun. I was with him. And as we were approaching the German line, we could see them all lined up firing. It couldn't have been very accurate fire, and what he did was to drop his gun and open fire on them.
From the hip?
Yes. From down here, and he did enough frightening that they cleared off with the I've never seen it done before, but he said it tried and it seemed to be a success. Well, you couldn't do it for very long. You'd only 100 rounds, I think, in your magazine. But anyway, we got into these trenches, and there were a lot of huts around as well, and I think it had been a stabling area at one time. Now, there was a sergeant and about six of us got into this place, and the sergeant said to me, the machine gunners are busy over the flanks. He says, we don't seem to have much here. He says, watch that side there. And we had the Lewis gun. I took it over and I kept well down, and there were Germans all around. I could see them 100 yards away, 50 yards away, just looking round, seeing where we were. I knew the old game. They wanted me to open fire, some of us, to know where we were, but we wouldn't do it. Because the other chaps were in the up with a sergeant, out of the view of anybody, and I was the only one left in this place. And there was a Lance Corporal from the, I don't know which, could have been the Northumberland Fusiliers or some other northern regiment. And he stood up in one of these huts looking out. And I shouted to him, I says, get down. Too late, he got it straight through here. Watched him drop into the... That's what the Germans were waiting for, pick you off one by one. So I was watching keenly and I heard a noise behind me. I looked round, there were two Germans fully armed, right at the back of me. They could have shot me for what I knew. I didn't know they were in this hut. So I called on the sergeant. When I turned round, I heard them scattering back. I called on the sergeant. I said, there's two fully armed Germans in here. I said, I couldn't leave my post, otherwise I should have been wrong, you see. I had to get somebody else to do it. He went in, brought them out. The year was about 18, none older than what I was. And he spoke a little German, and from them we got to know that they'd been their first attack they'd ever been in. It was supposed to be a counter-attack, this, but it failed. I never saw any sign of them counter-attacking. And there were bank clerks from Berlin just being called up. They'd about 3 months' service in. And they were right pleased to be prisoners. They didn't like what they'd seen. So we stayed there until it were dark. We were cut off. We'd gone a bit too far, I think. Well, the Germans didn't know where their line was, and they were reorganising, and while they were reorganising and that, we managed to get out. And I, about 8 or 9 of us with Sergeant, we were collecting some of us own wounded who lost direction. We picked up a few Germans. They were wounded, arm wounds and that. And some of them we took as prisoners, and by the time we got back to our own lines, there were more of them than there were of us. They were giving up. Otherwise, it had been a bit of a struggle in the dark. They'd have probably turned and attacked us.
This all sounds very different and much more confusing. And
it was a confused area.
Than your previous experience 2 years
very
before.
Confused, yes. And we then waited until we were taken to rejoin the battalion, and we were taken further back and reorganised.
Were you suffering a lot of casualties? I mean, if you were attacking regularly, you must have been suffering.
Yes, we were. Mm.
Was that affecting the battalion's morale, or were you getting regular?
No, you got that used to it. You just took it, well, it's not me today, attitude. No, I don't think we had lost any, as far as I were concerned, I don't think chaps that were around me had lost any of the idea of winning the war. Their idea was like mine, we had to win the war.
You weren't suffering from battle fatigue, or?
Later on you did, yes.
A bit later on, and we'll come to it then, yes.
Yes.
So where did you go from there?
I thought my... we went to a place named Banks Reserve Trench System.
And whereabouts was that, Derby? Behind St. Ledger?
Just further away, yes. I should think on the flank. And it was a quiet place. The only thing we were troubled by was German machine gun fire. Now, we went then in reserve. Yes, on that that position where we handed over to the Gordon Islanders, we then retired to trenches east of Amblin Court again. The losses we had then, as far as I could get to know, were nearly 300 officers and men. I think we were left with 3 officers and a few hundred men, very few. It was the Gordon Islanders, a new division relieved as the Gordon Islanders took over from St. Ledger area. And I remember them well because... I'd better not say it.
They were drinking?
Heavy.
What were they drinking?
Whiskey.
Going up to the line?
Yes, took over from us. Oh, well, yes, they had. It was the usual thing, you see. I mean, as an officer, I suppose you were allowed so much. Mind you, he knew what he was doing, but I knew he'd had...
It was the officer that was drunk, not the men then?
No, the men. It was the officer. He'd had plenty to drink. I don't blame him, mind you, because he had to show the lead all the time, hadn't he? And it was probably Dutch courage he needed.
So after this period in reserve at Hamlin Corps?
We went reserve in the south of St. Ledger. And then we went towards the Hindenburg line.
Whereabouts exactly?
Well, somewhere towards Ball and Wood area. We moved further down there, Flesh Quarries and other places. Anyway, at this time, I was asked if I would become a section leader. I was about one at in the company with about as much service in as anybody.
But you'd only been there since March.
Well, previous service. The previous service, you see. And also, I've been in a lot longer than a lot of them were. Probably duration of war and reserves and had all gone, and these have been recalled up, you see. And it was Sergeant Silver who asked me if I'd be... I said no.
Why did you say no?
He said, what's the reason? I said, well, I'll tell you. I said, I'm only 18. I said, I don't like giving orders to men. They were mature men, you know. I said to these, I said, old enough to be my uncle, more or less. I said, I don't like it. I said, it might be telling some of these chaps who were married to go and do a job which meant they were being killed. I said, don't like having the job at all. I wouldn't have it. So I got out of it.
How did you get on with these older men? Because they were coming in now with the conscription, and how did you youngsters mix with them?
Well, they were quite willing to listen to what you told them. They knew you had the experience, and they knew what you could tell them might mean the difference between surviving the war or being killed. And I was always ready to try and tell them exactly what the position was and what to do and how to avoid becoming a casualty and survive. You couldn't do it over the top, but you could take various precautions elsewhere to just...
What sort of precautions?
Never expose yourself, no matter whether you think it's quiet or not. That's when you get the snipers busy. Never go show yourself in daylight above a trench or any part. Keep undercover all the time and avoid having a fire going which gives smoke, and avoid giving away any indication where you are by moving. And in the open country, the grass would move if you moved in it, if it were long grass. And if there was any bushes, never move the bushes at all. That was one of the things which the Germans always took to mean there was somebody there, and of course they'd let go.
Were you in any, you were in the Flesh Quarries, Bourlon Wood area, were you in any attacks there?
At the Hindenburg line. We took over, we set off from where we were at the time, I forget the name of the place. And we marched towards the jumping off place for attacking the Canal du Nord, which was a dry canal, and to the Hindenburg line. Now, on the way up, the 18 pounders were wheel to wheel. I've never seen as many guns there on a front. And the ammunition was stacked as high. And the gunners told us when we kept having to stop, they were busy getting all ready. They said they were going to put a shell on every 3 yards of trench and keep it up. They said, you won't have any difficulty if we can keep that up for a few minutes for you. Anyway, at 4:05 in the morning, there was one gun fired. That was a signal. No blowing whistles, that was a signal of the attack. And off we went. The barrage opened. It was deafening. The Coldstream Guards were leading. We were the battalion behind them. And we had to go down a dry trench. And then there was this big concrete-lined empty canal.
How deep was it?
About 20 feet. There were scaling ladders. We had to go down and then climb up the other side with full equipment, and that the Coldstreams had done a good job because there were no opposition to us.
You weren't under fire then?
not from that part till later. There was no opposition, and we got into the Hindenburg trench, followed the Coldstreams were going ahead, and we had to take the flank, turn to the flank, because we had to face any attack from the left which the Germans might put in. And we looked towards Borland Wood, and in the distance we could see the German artillery being pulled out of the outskirts of the wood, and they were galloping on the road with the guns, but we couldn't do anything, it was too far off for effective rifle fire, and there were no other means, so they just got away. Now in the I went across an open field, there were no edges, it was just open, and right in the centre was a gun, big emplacement for a gun, sunk, you couldn't see it until you got on top of it nearly. And that had never been fired, apparently. One of the defences of the Hindenburg line, which was kept quiet and only to be used in case of an attack, and it failed. We're too quick.
What were the trench systems like of the Hindenburg line?
I've never seen a trench system like it in my life. That's enormous strength. There were wood, I should think, 2 feet square. Tremendous strength, all well built up, everything was immaculate as regards firing position.
How deep were the trenches and wide?
Oh, there were dugouts as well, plenty of dugouts there. Oh, there were enormous trench system, and the strength was tremendous. How it was taken like that, it must have been the artillery fire what caused the...
So the barbed wire defences and everything else?
There weren't any. There weren't, because the canal, empty canal was his barbed wire. You couldn't go down and across and up without Eno, and they were just at the side looking down.
How do you think the Coldstreams had done it then?
The artillery fire had kept them, knocked them out. There were quite a few wounded and dead in the trenches we went through before we went flat.
But do you think they could have done, I mean, there'd been big bombardments before the first day of the Somme, for instance. Do you think they could have done it without the German army not being quite so keen on holding, or do you think this was a new form of artillery?
I think there was beginning to not be so wishing to stand and fight. I think the morale of the German army was going, you know.
Do you think they could have taken it against the 1916 Germans?
No, no. It was a tremendously strong area, Hindenburg line. I went round it again later on, and I was never have I seen anything as strong. The supporting beams they had, and the dugouts, and the method in which they left one or two men watching, and all the others were undercover until they used to rely on the final whistle. And this time, of course, there wasn't any whistle. It was the gun, I think. Probably they didn't realise it.
So you got into the front, you actually got into the front line?
Yes, I went along quite a way from the German machine gun fire, which was coming from the left. You see, we were the left flank.
You went towards it then?
And we went that way. As soon as we made the frontal attack, we then got into this trench system, and we had to then follow one another and cause a left flank, so we were in order to face any German attack coming that way.
How did you go along the trench? Were you trained in any special method?
No, we just followed the officer and sergeant. And
you didn't bomb from bay to bay?
No, they'd gone, the Germans had gone, there were no Germans in, only dead and wounded. And
you didn't go out of the front line or into the second line? You just
Yes, we followed from the front line right along towards the end of his trench system, and then we got out into the open.
And that's where you found this gun in the field?
Yes, it had never been fired. Looked to me as if the chaps had gone up, cleared away and left it. The German team cleared away. They couldn't have done much good with it, you see, because it was for more or less, I should think, by the size of it, for a back area bombardment.
Was it a howitzer or a gun?
It was a howitzer. Probably a 5.9.
So and where did you go, what did you do then?
We then followed the officer, and as we were going on this road to take up a position facing the German and the wood, you could see the Germans were firing machine guns at such a distance that the bullets were just dropping at the end of the range. They were too far away to make use of them. You could see them dropping. They wouldn't have done any damage if they'd have, because they were spent, more or less. We got in this road and waited, and we didn't see a German. Not one in sight. All gone. And it was just a matter of sitting there and watching towards this Borland Wood area. And I think we were relieved shortly afterwards during the night, and instead of going to the back area, I think we went forward. The attack had been so successful. And if I remember, there were observation balloons up, and they were so close, German observation balloons, you could nearly see the men in them watching you with glasses. You're trying to get a bird's eye view, I suppose, of the limit of the British advance. And about a mile and a half away, according to what was said, the officers with the field glasses had seen German formations forming up in a field and marching away. Not coming forward, marching away, retiring. And we then, I think, advanced to a German run railway line. And in the distance, there was a big town, Cambrai, and it was on fire. You could see it, smoke and that going up. We went forward and stopped on a railway, this railway line, and there were odd Germans kept running in this. It was like a bit of a copse. It was a built-up railway line. We were looking down. There were a few Germans running around, and a few pot shots, but nobody hit anybody. So it was a matter then that it was open country. We went through a place that had been totally wrecked by our artillery, and it took a long time to get through it, having to go over places. We got out into open country, green fields and no barbed wire, no trenches, nothing.
How did you feel about that? Because you were used to trenches.
Were beautiful to see it, the green.
Did you not feel exposed, though?
Well, we'd been told the Germans were retiring. And they weren't standing, only odd times. And you needn't worry much and keep going. Well, the whole area was farmland, more or less. All open country. It was lovely to see it. And later on, I was taken with a section to a farmhouse. It was intact, and there'd been Royal Engineers had put the mark on that there was no booby traps in it. We went in there and we found the store of potatoes and carrots, and we got a fire going, and with the best feed we'd had for a long time. Just boiled potatoes and carrots. Wait until we were bursting. We never went out to see what was the other side. We were told we were all right where we were. There were plenty of covering parties in front of us. And nobody ever went upstairs to see if there was anybody up there. We just took a chance. The rail engineer said it was all right, and we took it over. And we had a real good night's sleep there. And next morning, we were on the move again. And as we opened the door to go to the back garden, there was a German laid full length out there. A young man he was, and it all his stomach had been ripped out. And he must have been there all night, probably day before, and died there.
Now, just before that was the incident when Holmes got his BC, and you knew Holmes, didn't you? Edgar Holmes.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that incident?
Well, that was...
Well,
that was an attack to a sugar beet factory, a place and a wood called Cotteneers, I think it is.
Yes, I think that's right.
Well, I was going across a field of growing cabbages with the company, and the this building was fairly substantial. And it was like it was built like a tower to allow traffic to go under and unload each side and all that sort of thing. And the Germans were up in the top. They had machine guns. And as soon as we got into the cabbage field to go forward, these machine guns opened out. And of course, chaps beginning to fall, so the officers get down and crawl. And we kept on crawling a little at a time and then stopping, because as soon as they moved a cabbage, he must have been got glasses and he'd get some machine guns going. It took a long time to get through this field and into the sunken road, and when we got together, they told us then about the stretcher bearer of the company, Holmes. He was a right nice chap. I knew him well. He was a chap about 6 feet and typical English person, fair hair, blue eyes. He'd joined in 1913, and I knew him very well. He always chap to have a joke with.
Did he strike you as the sort to do the sort of thing that gets you a VC before it happened?
No, he didn't. He struck me as a chap who would do his duty, but he wouldn't risk any more than necessary. So what apparently had happened, he'd gone out to some of our wounded and he'd dragged one in and he'd been hit by a bullet. He went out again and got another one in, and then he was hit again. He went out the third time and he got it through here.
Through the throat?
Mm, cut the main vein, artery. I forget the name of it anyway. And there was no hope for him, nothing could be done.
What do you think made him do that?
Well, he wanted to, it was as a stretcher bearer, it's your job to look after the wounded, and you've got to go and get them. So and he went out on his own. He was a very strong man, as I thought, and he'd probably be able to carry him in and drag him in. Or get a stretcher and drag him that way, you see.
So you think he probably saw it as his duty?
Yes, I did. I thought it'd be his duty to do that. Yes, I was very sorry when we heard about him, because he'd been out, I think, in 1914.
Do you remember anything else about him, or any stories that illustrate his character? Before then, obviously.
Well, as a stretcher bearer, he wasn't supposed to carry a rifle. But if one of the chaps on the march didn't feel up to it and was beginning to falter a bit, he'd, as a stretcher bearer, like as a medical attendant, he might go to him and give him a drink of water and then take his rifle and leave the other chaps to carry the stretcher. They have to carry stretchers, as you know. They didn't carry rifles or equipment. They were unarmed. They'd probably carry the rifle. It'd help a chap look at his feet as well after a march and try and patch them up if they wanted some attention. Because you might have had a long way to go to battalion headquarters to get the doctor, if it was so necessary. No, he was a very well liked chap.
Right, what's the next thing you remember that happened? Really, I know it's very difficult for you to remember because there's such a lot of small things happening on the shop. When you were at the farmhouse, what were you actually doing there?
Only for a night.
And where were you going?
We were going forward to Saint-Hilaire to get ready for another attack. Saint-Hilaire. Saint-H-I-A-I-R-E. I've got it pronunciation wrong, haven't I? Saint-Hilaire. That was before we entered that abandoned farmhouse.
And what happened the next day after you'd found this body?
Well, we set forward then for set forward and we made an attack